From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. A disappointed young suitor remained for years in the large old house overlooking Long Island Sound in which he had so suddenly died. The Haunting in Westchester by Cynthia James Coffey. The following is a true ghost story. Ghosts do not always occupy old houses, but this one did. The house was ready-made for the purpose, a vast labyrinth on the Westchester shore overlooking Long Island Sound. And the ghost himself seems to have had good cause for a lasting grievance. He was an unsuccessful suitor who had died prematurely and needlessly. The house, a shingled monstrosity which I adored, dominated 7 acres of majestic sagging trees. Undergrowth was encroaching from all directions, since the owner and gardener had both grown impossibly old. I was young. I loved the old place, with its magnificent view of the sound, the rocky shoreline, the marvelous pools for swimming. The house had been built in the 1890s, when wealthy Manhattan residents had summer mansions in which to get away from it all, some 40 or 50 miles from the city. It had been constructed at the order of the mother of an old woman I knew. In this family, the women had the money. But even if they had been broke, they would have been matriarchal and dominant. The daughter, my acquaintance, was Julia Ellsworth Ford, widow of Simeon Ford, a gay blade and New York's unofficial toastmaster in the early 1900s. One of their three children was the painter Lauren Ford, whose best-known work is Christ in Connecticut. She lived as a spinster on a self-sufficient farm tended by nuns. A few years ago, her life there was the basis of a motion picture starring Loretta Young. If ever a ghost had ample room in which to haunt, it was in the Ford sprawling Westchester home. Actually, it was made up of two houses, built to mirror each other. With 22 rooms each, they were built identically, but in reverse, all the way from the basement kitchen with its dumbwaiter to the mirrored maid cubicles on the third floor. Thus, the entrance halls were side by side, and the living rooms, though separated by a small expanse of porch, gazed not only at the sea but at each other. The upper floors were joined, and there were doors to pass from house to house. The attic was one long, unseparated expanse. I was told that originally there had been one house. When Mrs. Ford, Julia, married, her mother built the identical other house for her to summer in. After her parents died, Julia transferred to their side, so I, with my small children and husband, was living in her house. Throughout the years that I knew her, Julia supported and discarded a collection of adult waifs, as well as several faith healers, including one, I remember, who by just touching her forehead with his hand could dispel her headaches. Mrs. Ford believed in mind over matter, and that doctors mattered not. Many years ago, Julia's daughter, Lauren, who was nearly 6 feet tall and plain, had a chance to avoid spinsterhood. Her chance eventually became my ghost. The gentleman was visiting the Ford menage during his courtship of Lauren, and while there, complained of a pain in his side that was growing increasingly worse. Obviously, he needed a doctor, but Mrs. Ford would not allow it. He took to bed, and when his appendix burst, he died. Coincidentally, in the bed my husband and I later slept in. Naturally, I had heard the story of his tragic and senseless death, and that he had died in our bedroom, but it was certainly far from my mind on the afternoon in late summer when I encountered him. I had left the central bathroom, was walking back to the bedroom, and there he was, standing about 6 feet from the bedroom door. I knew immediately he was a ghost or spirit, for in photographic terms one might say that he was overexposed. He was wearing jodhpurs and a white shirt, a mature person in his mid-twenties, looking neither fair nor dark because of an overall graininess of the impression. I also knew immediately who he was. I'm not overly quick, but the process of elimination did not take long. He watched me approach with what I would call a reflective expression that showed neither animosity nor amiability. It simply never occurred to me to retreat. As I walked past him into the bedroom, I knew he had turned his head and was watching me. I shut the door, which was illogical, I guess, since from childhood we know that ghosts can pass through anything. I believe I shut the door as the normal reaction of a woman alone in a house. I don't remember where the children were, but I do remember very well that I was alone, with a somewhat strange man. I also remember that I stayed in the bedroom until my husband returned from work. By then the ghost was gone. The next morning, Julia's old maid revealed that of course he was haunting the house, and had done so for years. She had seen him several times in the attic, and hadn't I noticed that I could never keep a maid? That was because he, for his own reasons, didn't want anyone living on the third floor, and made his presence known by heavily pacing up and down all night, slamming doors, opening windows that had been shut against the rain, and, with a crash, shutting windows that were left open on a hot summer's night to catch the breeze. With four children, it had never occurred to me that the reason for the steady flow of help had been a disgruntled ghost. Both my husband and I had noticed an awful lot of noise drifting down from the third floor, but had attributed it to the grumbling character of an old house, or even to the maids themselves. The noises continued, and with our new knowledge of the cause, I'm afraid our romance with the house was drawing to an end. Our days and nights there were numbered. In late October, Julia passed on. As she had requested, her open coffin was placed on a tilt in front of a bay window in the dining room, and for 3 days she looked out to the Sound. Shortly thereafter, the heirs auctioned off the furniture in both houses. The morning of the auction, a storm began to brew. By noon, it was a gale washing away the artist's studio on the point and ripping out the remains of the tennis court. Waves leaped easily over the seawall, finally managed to fell an ancient tree, which toppled the width of the lawn and sprawled up the stone steps of the front porch. It was marvelously exciting, and I must admit I was laughing to myself. After the auction, the hardy souls who had braved the elements for the pickings discovered, to their great annoyance, that they were unable to move their cars because another huge tree had fallen across the driveway, sealing them in. It occurred to me that now the house had two ghosts, one on each side. About 2 years later, after the house too had been auctioned off, it literally went up in smoke. They say one could see the blaze over the water for miles. The firemen didn't even try to put it out, as the whole building appeared to go up at once. There were mutterings about an insurance fire, but that is a mundane concern and not mine. Many ghosts have been seen by many witnesses in an old building in New York City's West Side. The Ghost of 46th Street by Wainwright Evans. The following is a true ghost story. New York City has more haunted houses than ever get into the record. One reason it's hard to track them down is that the owners try to keep knowledge of their otherworldly visitors secret. There is one haunted house in New York, however, whose owner, up to the time when she recently sold the old building, made no secret of her ghost. And though she had moved out, presumably the ghost has not, and is still sticking around waiting for a team of investigators to come along and get acquainted. To find 422 and a half West 46th Street, the heart of Old Hell's Kitchen, you walk along the south side of the block between 9th and 10th Avenue, the time-battered tenements of what remains one of New York's worst West Side slums tower around you. Between 422 and 424, you come to a high wrought iron gate, still beautiful, plainly a relic of other days, mute evidence that once upon a time, New York was actually like that. You walk through that gate, up a narrow alley 30 feet long, and into a flagstone courtyard that seems to be from another world. Facing you is an old two-story building of time-mellowed brick, with a row of slender columns and graceful arches in front. Above them, a wrought-iron gallery runs the length of the building, with a crooked iron stairway at the left end that leads down to the court. At the time I visited this charming vestige of the past, it, together with the four-story tenement buildings that hid it from the street, was owned by Miss Ruth F., an artist, one of whose claims to fame is that she originated finger painting and for many years taught it as a therapy for psychotic patients at the Menninger Clinic in Topeka, Kansas. Here on West 46th Street was her home, and here the great studio where she taught her classes. Miss Shaw dotes on ghosts, makes something of a hobby of collecting them, and has for her favorite this lovely little ghost in crinoline, the delicate wraith of a pretty young girl whose appearances, Miss Shaw avers, always seems to be omens of something pleasant about to happen. To lend proper authority to Miss Shaw's observations of this 46th Street apparition, let's go back a bit. I've been seeing ghosts off and on ever since I was a child, Miss Shaw said as matter-of-factly as if she were discussing the weather. I'm not in the least afraid of them. You see, I was raised with four brothers in Wilmington, North Carolina, by two old Negro mammies who conditioned me to ghosts, and who were on speaking terms with very important ghosts in that region. They singled me out as worthy of their best efforts because I had been born with a call. They taught me their techniques for seeing ghosts, and I took it as much for granted as my three meals a day. There was a lot of voodoo in it, but along with all the superstition, I'm sure they had something and were in many ways definitely psychic. If I am in any degree psychic myself, I think I probably owe some of it to them. My family were strict Presbyterians. My parents were about as unsuperstitious as any you could find. My mother would have been horrified if she had known the kind of education I was getting from the women to whom she had entrusted me. They had special rules for me, as distinct from the other children who hadn't had the luck to be born with a call. For instance, at meals, if we had chicken, I always had to have equal portions of white and dark meat. If I had been given a green vegetable, I had to have an equal amount of a light-colored vegetable. I was always bathed in a special tub, never used for the other children, and there always had to be a flower, preferably blue, floating on the water. Mammy Catherine trained her young pupil to an alert sensitivity to sounds, to voices in the night, to thunder. Mammy Jenny concentrated on teaching her the techniques of seeing ghosts. First, Miss Shaw explains you had to have a feeling, and to get that you had to go through certain rites, rites which Mammy taught her during picnics in the woods, when the child's strict Presbyterian family were not around to interfere. If they came to a warm spot in the woods, Mammy Jenny would explain, that's a ghost. The idea was that the ghost was sending out messages or warm signals to see if you were receptive. On the other hand, a cold spot was a ghost too, but an evil one. Then the thing to do was button up your pockets and clothes tight to keep it out. But to a good ghost, you opened up your clothing and told the ghost to make itself at home. One way to see a ghost, Mammy Jenny instructed, was to look at it through a Lazy Lawrence over your left shoulder. Lazy Lawrences were heat waves. When you saw heat waves, that was the earth panting. Ghosts would rise under such conditions, and if you doubted that, you had only to look at those heat waves. Seeing is believing. If you wanted to see a lot of ghosts, you should look over your left shoulder at a blue gum standing behind a hot stove. It is very hot in hell, consequently, the earth breaks and cracks, and that's a means of escape for wicked spirits, so never step on a crack, because if you close the crack by stepping on it, the bad spirit will get revenge. If you happen to come across a dead rat, look out. A dead rat, if it was grinning, would attract wicked ghosts from across the sea. But you could offset this danger by a simple trick. You collected as much spittle in your mouth as you could while you walked three times around the dead rat, and then you spat at the rat over your left shoulder. If you hit the rat, that would kill the evil ghost. When you ate food, you were asked to take a blessing from the Great Spirit, and whenever you talk to anybody, you should talk to the Great Spirit in that person. And of course, that meant you'd be polite, a rule of voodoo-born courtesy with children, so taught carried over into their dealings with adults and vice versa. Now, can you think of a better prescription for good manners than that? Miss Shaw asked. But did they really teach you to see ghosts? Well, Miss Shaw said slowly, I often feel that there is more to all that superstitious nonsense than meets the eye. Something does seem to happen. I'm seeing them, but a certain consciousness seems to come immediately afterward, like the memory of a dream. It is purely a personal thing, and probably has little or no evidential value. But sometimes it seems to line up pretty definitely with things that are now more or less a commonplace in the study of extrasensory perception. It merges over into the psychic quirk in me that has caused me many, many times to see apparitions, and there is no doubt in my mind that I do see them. For example, one of the most poignant experiences of my life was something that happened when my mother died in Rome. I was with her. Like me, she was psychic. She called my four brothers and my father to her bedside, telepathically, if you like. All I know is that I saw their apparitions as I stood there. Two of my brothers were dead, so was my father, and my two remaining brothers were in America, one in Philadelphia, the other in South Carolina. Father stood at the foot of the bed, the others on either side. She talked to them, but they did not speak. Later I learned from my two living brothers that they knew she was dying and had summoned them, and the one in Carolina even called the one in Philadelphia by phone. So strong was the impression. As they stood beside the bed, I even saw the clothes they were wearing. The one living in Carolina was without his coat because the weather down there was very warm, and he came, so to speak, just as he was. The other was wearing his naval uniform and came just as he was, too. I verified these points later. Here, I feel, is what may be regarded as a transformation of those crude superstitions I was taught as a child into something that any modern experimenter in psychic research would recognize as being in line with other similar evidence. That kind of thing, especially the seeing of apparitions, has happened to me so many times that there is no doubt in my mind that my little ghost in crinoline is definitely a recurring apparition, and not just a figment of my imagination. What the explanation may be, I don't know, but I am sure it happened. And then Miss Shaw told me about her favorite ghost. Immediately after she bought the old building, she set about finding out all she could about its history by questioning old-timers in the neighborhood. Among these were a 90-year-old druggist at 46th Street and 9th Avenue. His name was Oates, and he knew all the local legends. While she was never able to find any documentary proof, Miss Shaw believes the building dates back to about 1809, or a little earlier. The plaster is of a type used in the 1700s. It seems to have been the coach house of Governor Clinton, first governor of New York. According to Mr. Oates, the Clinton coachman lived in the upstairs rooms, over four stables, on the ground floor. The coachman was English, and his wife was a Danish girl, young, newly arrived from Denmark, and very lonely and homesick. One evening, this homesick young woman saw, or thought she saw, an apparition of the Old Moor, as he was locally called, who somewhat earlier had been brought by ship to New York, tried for mutiny at sea, and hanged at the Battery. He was buried at what is now 45th Street and 10th Avenue, then a potter's field, and far to the north of the limits of the city at that time. This was just around the corner from the old coach house. After the execution, the spectators filed past the grave and threw in stones, a custom at that time. From then on, according to local belief, the Moor's restless ghost roamed the neighborhood. The coachman's wife, frightened by these stories about the ghost, saw him one day, or thought she did. Terrified, she ran down the stairs from the wrought iron gallery on the front of the coach house to her mistress for comfort and reassurance. She was pregnant, and a little later, one night before her baby was due, she ran down the stairs, fell, and died of the fall. The baby, born of a miscarriage, was saved. Thereafter, the coachman took care of the baby, a boy. But whenever the baby became ill, an apparition of the mother would be seen on the stairs below the gallery. As the baby grew older, the apparition was seen no more. Such was the story the mistress of the estate used to tell her grandchildren. That, at any rate, was a version Miss Shaw got from Mr. Oates and other local old-timers. Among the grandchildren of the Clinton family was an imaginative young girl named Margaret. She asked questions. What happens if the ghost comes and you are not here? Or, may I be a ghost and run down the stairs? Thereafter, Margaret made a game of pretending she was the ghost of the coachman's wife. She would put on old-fashioned clothes and run down the stairs. She did it once too often. One day she tripped and fell and died of the fall, and so became a ghost herself. In the years that followed, there was a continuing tradition that Margaret's charming little apparition was to be seen from time to time, coming down those fatal stairs. In the course of time, the old building became an abandoned ruin, and local Hell's Kitchen bums would gather there at night to sleep in the four old stables. One of the old-timers among the bums told Miss Shaw, soon after she took the place, that one day a group of these men saw the girl's ghost in the abandoned courtyard. Frightened, they ran out into the street, and it was a week before they dared come back there to sleep. Later still, the old man said, a Mr. Manconi, an artist, bought the place and made a studio of it, and now a lady owns it, he added, not knowing Miss Shaw was the lady. They say the ghost runs down the stairs again, but the bums don't go there no more, because a lady owns it. After Miss Shaw bought the place, she went to California for a time to lecture on finger painting. When she got back, she took rooms across the court from the coach house till the lease of her tenants there should expire. From these rooms, she could plainly see the balcony and the stairs. She had rather discounted the story of the ghost and was expecting nothing in particular to happen. But one day late in the afternoon, I saw her, Miss Shaw said. I saw her very plainly. She wore a white blouse and a full crinoline skirt with a pattern of light blue flowers. There were two bands on the skirts. The blouse was cut low in front and had very full sleeves. It was a peasant type of blouse, of a kind stylish in the old days. Her hair was bound with a light blue band. Her shoes were black, ballet type, and laced across the top. She wore white stockings. Her neck was long, and her delicate profile showed a cute little retroussé nose. I didn't see the front of her face, but I saw enough to know she was very pretty. Her hair, which came halfway down her back, bounced and floated as she moved. She held her hands out in front of her, and she seemed to sort of float down the stairs, though she was plainly running. I saw her that way 3 days in succession. I liked it, but Peggy, my Scotty, didn't. One night, when I was reading late, Peggy gave the alarm, a peculiar bark she never gives at any other time, a sort of terrified yip, and I knew from that my nice little ghost was walking again. One afternoon, when I was out in the court working with my flowers, Peggy yipped. I looked up, and there was the apparition, at once floating and running, down the stairs, with her hair lifting a little as she moved. I saw her in broad daylight, at a distance of about 20 feet, as plainly as I would have seen a real person on those stairs. Peggy began barking frantically, her hair bristling, and she ran around behind me. The apparition crossed the court diagonally in a straight course towards the alley leading to the street. She entered a passageway and vanished. I ran to the entrance, but could see nothing. Later I moved into the coach house, where I lived from then on. They didn't give me such a good view, but I continued to see the apparition from time to time. Sometimes all I got was the flash of her petticoat through the window as she passed. Peggy sleeps in the big chair near the window, and often at night she will spring up, giving that frightened yip, and come running and hop upon my bed, trembling all over. When was the last time you saw the apparition? About 6 weeks ago, 2 days before an art exhibit in my studio and in the courtyard. It included some of the finger paintings of my students and the work of some fellow artists. Most people in this neighborhood know about Margaret. I may own the house, but she is community property. It is too bad that space limitations forbid going into some of Miss Shaw's further adventures with apparitions. There was, for instance, the one she met some 25 years ago in an ancient building that still stands at the foot of East 43rd Street, now looking out on the United Nations building. He was a young sailor who presented himself at her door, his arm in a sling, and asked for Kitty. Kitty, it seemed, had been there only last night. Investigation later revealed that about 80 years ago, the building had been a bordello run by Madame Touche. Kitty was one of the girls. The sailor, furious at finding a man in Kitty's room, killed the fellow, ran out, fell, and broke his arm, hence the sling. But it is a long story. And then there's a time when Miss Shaw stopped at a hotel in a Utah town during one of her lecture tours and awoke at midnight to discover her room full of fighting men. She later learned that such a fight had taken place in that room between two rival gangs when the first railroad was being built. Several men had been killed, and the room had been considered haunted ever since. But that, too, is another story. A tall woman in white, born on board ship and befriended by a pirate, will not leave the house in which she died. A House in New Hampshire by Lewis M. A. Roy. The following is a true ghost story. I live near Henniker, New Hampshire, in a house that has come to be known as Ocean-Born Mary House. It was left to me by my mother when she died in 1949. I am convinced that my house is guarded by the spirit of Ocean-Born Mary Wallace, the original owner who died in 1814. This is a legend of the house, as it has been told to us. In 1720, a party of Scotch-Irish immigrants left Londonderry, Ireland, for its namesake town in New Hampshire, where most of the group had relatives and friends waiting for them. The Wolf, a little sailing vessel, had nearly completed its voyage and was approaching Boston Harbor when it was overtaken by a frigate flying the pirate's skull and crossbones. The unarmed Wolf found escape impossible. Every soul on board fell to his knees and prayed for deliverance. An evil-looking company from the interloper was soon clamoring aboard the hapless Wolf. Captain Pedro's crew, called the pirate chief, was a dour, taciturn man, but when he finally spoke, it was in an unexpectedly cultured, well-modulated English, and to tell the passengers and crew of the Wolf to prepare for death. At that moment, a sudden whimpering, like that of a helpless kitten, made him turn sharply around and then hurry down the companionway. When he reappeared on deck, legend says Pedro's cruel face was lighted by a grin. In minutes, everyone knew their lives had been saved by Mrs. James Wilson, the young wife of the captain, who had just given birth to a baby. She and the pirate chief had struck a strange bargain. If she would consent to name her newborn baby daughter Mary after Captain Pedro's mother, everyone on board the Wolf would be spared. Mrs. Wilson had been only too glad to agree. The pirates left as suddenly as they had come, and the passengers and crew of the Wolf were left to rejoice, but not for long. In no time at all, Captain Pedro was back, this time alone. The terrified people thought he had changed his mind, but he had returned to bring a christening gift, a bolt of exquisite greenish-blue brocaded silk, which he said he hoped would some day be made into Mary's wedding gown. The Wilsons were soon established in Londonderry, where Mary grew into an unusually lovely and unusually tall young woman. In 1742, at the age of 22, she was married to Thomas Wallace. Her wedding dress, fashioned of greenish-blue brocaded silk, was the perfect foil of her flaming red hair and milk-sheened skin. Ocean-born Mary, as Mrs. Wallace had been called since her unorthodox christening, had four strapping sons, all of whom were even taller than her six-foot mother. William, for instance, was 6'8". Meanwhile, Captain Pedro, apparently mellowed with years, decided to spend his old age free from violence. Accompanied by his ship's carpenters, black slaves, and a giant seaman who followed him about like a shadow. Captain Pedro came in 1760 to a lonely spot near Heinecker, where he built a stately Georgian house. He had kept close tabs on Mary. Now he sent a message inviting her and her boys to share his home, overlooking the Contoocook River and Mount Lovell. The widowed Mary came here with her sons to care for the old ex-pirate. She became dearer to him than a daughter, and he showered her with presents, including a dashing coach with four horses. About 10 years after Mary and her boys came to live in the house, Captain Pedro returned one night from a trip to the West Sea coast. Quickly and quietly, he and his hulking shadow buried a heavy chest outside the house. The gigantic seaman was never seen again. The legend says Mary heard anguished groaning during the night. Mary returned from a drive one day, sometime later, to find the house deserted and the slaves cowering miserably in an outshed. The body of Captain Pedro lay in the orchard, a sailor's cutlass thrust between his shoulder blades. In accordance with a wish he had earlier expressed, Mary had him buried beneath the ponderous hearthstone fronting the kitchen fireplace. After her sons went their own ways, ocean-born Mary lived on in her beloved house until her death at 94. She was buried in the Quaker Cemetery, Heinecker, in 1814. The house remained in the possession of the Wallace family until my mother bought it in 1916. It had then been vacant for 6 years. In 1918, we came overland from Wisconsin in a car I had built myself. We knew that the former owner of the sadly dilapidated ocean-born Mary House did not care to live in it. From neighbors, we learned that the roof had been leaking for over 20 years. My mother and I learned a great many other things about our new home. A number of owners had tried to take possession, but no one seemed able to live here. And of one thing, everyone seemed certain, that someone or something was guarding the house. It became evident that only those who loved the place and took proper care of it could live here in peace. We also learned that if the house was in danger, a mysterious influence invariably alerted a passerby, anyone, who somehow saved it. Here is one instance. About a week before we moved in, a gang of some 12 boys broke into the house. With vandalism in their hearts, they smashed the small glass panes in the windows, shot holes in the priceless moldings, and even knocked a chimney arch into the cellar. A Heinecker resident, who happened to be driving past, felt something was wrong. Obeying a strong compulsion, he made straight for the house. A trail of smoke was spiraling up from the chimney. The man from Heinecker opened the front door. Hearing noises, he followed them upstairs, where he encountered a gang in the loom room. A mattress had already been set on fire. The boys were starting to burn the rest of the house, too, but the man quickly put out the fire and the little monsters. Then he fastened the door as well as he could. The boys were afraid to return, but 6 months after my mother and I arrived, one of them told us that they had fully intended to come back later and finish the job. It just happened that we arrived and the house was saved, because something had impelled the man from Heinecker to stop and investigate. We were just here just a short time when one day my mother decided to build a fire in the kitchen stove. She told me that if I'd clean out the cupboard, she would burn the accumulated rubbish. I cleared the cupboards, and my mother soon had a good fire going in the stove. Then I cleaned one of the built-in dressers of the combination dining room kitchen and scooped out a paper bag from a corner. "What's in the bag?" my mother asked. I told her I hadn't looked. She agreed I might just as well throw it into the fire. But I was constrained, I know not by what, to check the contents. It turned out to be a few pounds of blasting powder. We had lived at the ocean-born Mary House for about a year, when one day I checked my homemade car and saw that part of the rim holding one of the tires was coming off. I decided to drive it back with a hammer. The air pressure in the tire was about 50 pounds. I hit the rim. Next thing I knew, I was lying on the ground about 15 feet from the car. The hammer was missing, and blood was streaming from my right temple. I rushed into the house and frightened my poor mother nearly to death. It was a close call, but I recovered. Several weeks later, I read a newspaper report about a truck driver who, attempting to pound a tire rim back with a hammer, was killed instantly an accident paralleling my own in every detail but the last one. Altogether, I have suffered 17 near-fatal accidents during my life at the ocean-born Mary House. From reading the newspapers, I know that other persons enduring identical mishaps did not fare so well. It seems to me that ocean-born Mary is protecting me, as I feel I am protecting her house. I guess I'll never forget the day preceding the hurricane that hit New England in 1938. It was raining unusually hard, so before attempting to drive my car through the storm, I walked down the hill to see how things looked. When I'd gotten about halfway down, I found that the entire road had been washed away, as if a giant bulldozer had removed it. As I fought my way back up the hill, bucking wind that was gaining momentum every second, I could see through the driven rain that trees around the house were starting to blow over. I neared home and saw that the small garage I had built was swaying precariously. I was afraid the car would be crushed unless I would manage to prop up the building. I had to work fast. I propped up the garage from the outside as well as I could and turned toward the house. I was drenched. When I was about 50 feet from the side entrance, my hat blew off. But I kept on until I saw that my mother had the side door open. The instant I reached the hall, she asked, "Who was that with you when you were working on the garage?" She thought it was one of the neighbors. I had seen no one, and certainly no one had been with me. That's what I told my mother, but she was obdurate. While I was busy with the garage, she insisted a lady in white accompanied me. Then, as my hat blew off, my mother had followed it with her eyes. When she looked back, the woman had vanished. One summer afternoon, while mother was alone in the house, she answered a knock at the front door. A woman she did not know explained that she had come over to see the rest of the house. When they were seated in the Eagle Room, my mother asked her visitor what she meant by seeing the rest of the house. The woman said that years before she had lived in Henniker, before moving to her new home in Massachusetts, she decided she would see the house everyone talked about. "I knocked on the front door," she told my mother, "and a woman opened it. She let me in and showed me this room, but she seemed unwilling to show me the rest of the house, and that's what I've come to see now." My mother asked if her visitor could recall the date of her first call at the ocean-born Mary House. She had no trouble remembering. Strangely, no one had been living in the house then. In fact, it had been vacant for some time. "What did the woman look like?" my mother demanded, only to be told that she'd been extraordinarily tall, something like 6 feet. Passersby insist that they have seen mysterious lights in the multi-pane windows of the ocean-born Mary House when it was uninhabited. Many persons claim to have seen the coach and four clattering across the yard where the old post road used to be. The coach is said to pull up to the oaken entrance. A very tall woman in filmy white steps out and walks gingerly to the side of the house, throws a packet into the old well, then hurries back to the waiting coach, whereupon all vanish. This phenomenon, they say, occurs late in October around Halloween, at midnight or thereabouts. According to legend, a man saw this phantom reenactment about 75 years ago. So much for the old legend. Here is a more recent tale. Some years ago, a young woman from Concord came here with some friends. She commented on the phantom coach, and I asked her what she knew about it. This is what she told me. Her brother, whose name was Foster, came out here a few years before in the latter part of October. With him was Scott Rogers, a Concord police officer. The party, which included two other young men, parked at the side of the road. They saw the ghostly coach and four promptly at midnight. The young woman told me that her brother came home incoherent with fright. She promised to bring him to see me, but she said it would have to be in broad daylight. A year passed and they never appeared, but the following summer an elderly woman visited with some people from Concord. I asked her what she knew about the story. She told me that her son, a fellow named Foster, once came here with Scott Rogers and that both saw the apparition. Her son could never be persuaded to return, not even in broad daylight. About a year ago, I learned from another visitor that she had come up to the house one night in late October and parked the car at the side of the road. She said she positively heard the rumble of approaching coach wheels, but saw nothing. The ocean-born Mary House is an outstanding example of Georgian architecture. It has attracted thousands of tourists, among them distinguished architects, historians, and authorities on psychic phenomena. The place reflects a seafarer's influence. Its fine stairs boast high hand railings, and the floors of the back room slope. The house is exquisitely paneled. One of its most striking features is the ornately carved stairway on which Mary's figure has been seen and on which mysterious footsteps are occasionally heard. In the antique kitchen, there is a ponderous hearthstone with a hole drilled in the center. Many repeatedly psychic visitors say they receive the impression that there is something beneath the slab. As I have said earlier, this something is supposedly the body of Captain Pedro. Some sources claim he was a titled British gentleman who did not want his relatives and friends to know he had turned pirate. As for the treasure that is supposed to be buried on the premises, nearly every visitor has this firmly in mind. Spiritualistic mediums, water diviners, and persons who come equipped with electronic devices. One medium said she elicited from Mary's spirit the information that the treasure is buried beneath an old tree, but she did not say which. The well at the side of the house has been examined, but there appears to be nothing there. The place has received more than its share of publicity. It has been described by historians and folklorists, including the author Carl Carmer. Currently, there's a move afoot to make it oriental motion picture with the house itself as background. Antique fanciers believe that the ocean-born Mary's house abounds with treasure other than Captain Pedro's. The treasure of fine antiques and the indefinable aura of early Americana that graces every corner of the old house. If you ask me, the grandest treasure here is a small piece of greenish-blue brocaded silk. And there is my own personal treasure. My feeling that, beyond a doubt, I live in the house that haunts a ghost who cannot forget it. And I believe she continues to shield me from harm, because she knows I care about the house just as much as she did.